This tape contains the third of six teachings in the series entitled Introduction to the Old Testament, Part 7, The Writings. The speaker is the Reverend John W. Howe, rector of Truro Episcopal Church in Fairfax, Virginia. The title of this teaching is Esther.
If you would find the book of Esther. Once again, we come to an absolutely marvelous story. And perhaps as much as any book in the Bible, it deserves simply to be read. And in fact, that's one of the main reasons why they call these the writings. You know, this section that we're closing up our introduction to the Old Testament with, it's called the writings because they're just great stories for the most part. They're great stories, and there's very little to be added to this. This book, probably more than any other, perhaps the book of Ruth is similar, just speaks for itself, and what you need to do is read it. And that's what we're going to do tonight. And I'm going to ask several of you to help, because I want to read almost all of it, because there's really very little to be added just to what the scripture itself says. That is exactly what the Jews do on the Feast of Purim in the spring. This year it comes on March 18th. Purim or Purim, it's sometimes called the Feast of Lots, and that means from casting lots, casting dice, casting lots to determine something, and that's what we find in chapter 3. They were casting lots, and that's where the name comes from. If you go to Israel today, at the time of the Feast of Purim, you'll find that children dress up much as our children do on Halloween. And they go around seeking, you know, it's not trick or treat, it's just treat. Just give me a treat. They go around and get little goodies from their neighborhood in honor of Esther, in honor of the lady we're about to read about. I put some dates up here on the blackboard just to put this into context. You remember that the Jews began returning from Babylon in 536 BC. After they had been exiled, God had punished them and chastised them and allowed them to go off to Babylonian exile, and they began to come back 536. And you remember from last time that the temple was rebuilt during a 20-year period from 536 to 516 BC. Esther was a Jewish lady, and she ended up becoming queen of Persia through the most extraordinary set of circumstances. She was Xerxes' wife, Xerxes' queen. She became queen in 478. And the events that we're reading about take place approximately 5 years later. When she is involved, she is instrumental in saving her people from massacre, from Holocaust, in 473. And just to refresh your memory from a couple of weeks ago, Ezra went from Babylon to Jerusalem in 457, and Nehemiah came 13 years later to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem in 444. So if you just look at those dates for a second, as I intimated last time, it's almost certain that Esther was still alive and a very influential queen mother during the time of Artaxerxes, who was the one who gave permission for the rebuilding of the wall to Nehemiah. And it's very, very probable that it was her influence over her stepson. She had become queen. She's now the queen mother. Very influential lady. It's probable that it's her influence behind the throne that made him so amenable to Nehemiah. And so you see, she's responsible for the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. And in a moment, we'll see she's directly responsible for something much, much more important than that, for literally saving her whole generation, her whole people, from massacre. I wonder if somebody, let me start with Kelly, because he's an expert at this, okay? If Kelly would stand and read for us the whole of chapter 1.
In the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and servants, the army chiefs of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces being before him. While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the capital, both great and small, a banquet lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And there were white cotton curtains and blue hangings caught up with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and marble pillars and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the king and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to the law. No one was compelled, for the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as every man desired. And Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the woman in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bista, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served King Ahasuerus as chamberlains, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come as the king's command conveyed by the eunuchs, and at this the king was enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshena, Chesha, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, was it to be done to Queen Vashti because she was not performing the command of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs? And then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the princes, not only to the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also to all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will be telling it to all the king's princes, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go forth before him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be altered, that Vashti is to come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands high and low. And this advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed, and he sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be lord in his own house and speak according to the language of his people.
Thank you, Kelly. You did very well with all those names. That's great. Okay, King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, that's his other name, ruled Persia from 485 to 465 BC. And you get a little glimpse into what it must have been like. Very powerful king, very wealthy king, had nobles and princes at his beck and call, had this huge set of chamberlains, had consorts and eunuchs to serve him, and so on. We know from Persian inscriptions and records that the great feast that's described here was held in preparation for a very famous expedition that Xerxes made against Greece, in which he fought the battles of Thermopylae and Salamis in 480 BC. And on the eve of that expedition, that military adventure, He calls for his queen to come in and show her beauty. Now, scholars will argue about exactly what that means. Some think that he was asking her to do something immoral, to come and perform with just her crown on, or something like that. And others will say, no, that's not the issue. She was just a rebellious wife. Okay? She just didn't want to come. She didn't want to have anything to do with that party. In either case, what is clear is that it was feared that her refusal would lead to a wholesale rebellion of wives against their husbands. And so Xerxes says she's got to be deposed. His advisors say she's got to be deposed. We can't have that. All the wives of the whole kingdom will follow the example of the queen. If she won't obey the demand of her husband, the king, then what hope does any lowly, ordinary husband have that he's going to rule over his household? And so we have the first case of... What? What are you saying, Sue? That gets to you? That's right. That's right. Excedrin number 47, right? Look at verse 19. Very important. If it please the king, let a royal order go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be altered. That's a key to understanding this book. An edict of a Persian king could not be changed once it was issued, even by the king himself. Once the edict has been given, it can't be changed. And so he demands that his wife come and entertain the party, and for whatever reason, either because it's an immoral request or because she simply doesn't want to, or maybe she has a headache or whatever it is, she says no, and his advisors say, get rid of her. That is a terrible example. We can't have that going on. Let an edict go forth. Let a royal order go forth according to the laws of the Persians and the Medes. And so he does that. And so she is, in essence, deposed. Somebody read chapter 2, verses 1 through 18. Can somebody do that for me? Please.
After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch who is in charge of the women. Let their ointments be given them. Let the maiden who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away when Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He had brought up Hadashah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was beautiful and lovely, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many maidens were gathered in Susa, the capital, in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the maiden pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her ointments and her portion of food, and with seven chosen maids from the king's palace, and advanced her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now when the turn came for each maiden to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, When the maiden went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she came back to the second harem in custody of Shahazgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She did not go into the king again, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet to all his princes and servants. It was Esther's banquet. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal liberality.
Okay, the plot begins to thicken. Mordecai is already an influential person, but he's keenly aware of the prejudice against the Jews, and so he tells Esther to keep her nationality a secret. I want you to notice the care with which these maidens are preparing themselves. Perfumes, ointments, beauty treatment that takes a whole year. You want to talk about the total woman? You know, I mean, they knew what they were up to, right? And so, lo and behold, without disclosing that she is Jewish, she becomes the most favored out of all these maidens who are brought before Xerxes. And he picks her, and he crowns her, and she becomes the queen instead of Vashti. There's a footnote on this chapter. Notice in verse 19, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. And in those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. Mordecai is demonstrating his loyalty here. Nothing immediately comes of this, but just put that on the back burner because it'll come back again. The king lodges it away in the record. And it's a very important footnote. At this point, the villain comes onto the scene, and his name is Haman. And when we were in Israel several years ago, we happened to be there at the time of the Feast of Purim, and we're traveling through the land on this great commuter bus, and as we're rolling along, we're reading this whole blessed book, okay? And what you do in Israel, whenever the name of Haman is mentioned, you go, see? So you got to get into this thing here, all right? Haman is the chief of staff, and he's got delusions of grandeur. He expects everybody to bow down to him as they would normally bow down to a king. And I wonder if somebody would read for us chapter 3. Lynn, would you do that? Did you stand? Everybody get ready. You got to go.
After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman. For so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" Now it was, when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether...
Come on, you gotta really do it.
see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day, and from month to month, until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business, to put into the king's treasuries." Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha of the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please."
Let me stop you there. Thank you very much. Haman convinces the king that there's an insurgency brewing. It's not true.
The Jews are at this point very loyal to the king, but he convinces him that there's an insurgency brewing and that the final solution, if you'll permit me that phrase, is their annihilation. What's going on in the background is that he is bugged out of his mind by Mordecai. Maybe others as well, but Mordecai most explicitly refuses to go along with this demand that people bow down and do obeisance to Haman. And Mordecai just will not do that. And you got to remember the background of this. They were sent into captivity in the first place. Why? What was the reason? Why did God allow the Jews to be sent into captivity? What was the problem? Exactly. Because they had compromised on the issue of idolatry. "I, the Lord your God, am the only Lord, and you will have no gods before me." And they had allowed idol worship, and they had allowed all manner of compromise of that. And it was to purge them of that, that they were sent into the Babylonian captivity in the first place. And Mordecai says, "No way am I going to bow down before this ridiculous little guy, Haman." And like Daniel, yes. Dave, you're going to have fun selling this tape, I got to tell you. We're going to have a special on this one, right? 22 cents for this tape. Whole tape full of hissing. Like Daniel and his three friends who said, "Hey, go ahead. Throw us into the lion's den. Throw us into the fiery furnace. God is able to save us, but even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down before you." Exactly where Mordecai is coming from. They said that to Nebuchadnezzar. He says that to Haman. And so Haman gets his back up about all of this. Everybody else apparently is willing to pay him this kind of obeisance, but Mordecai won't. And so he says, there's rebellion brewing. And he convinces the king that there's an insurgency coming up and that they've got to be annihilated. Now, let me just skip ahead a little bit. The whole story, the whole book, pivots on chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the midst of the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. He could only come to the entrance. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was a great mourning among the Jews. The king had said, Haman's right, we're going to get rid of these people. Wherever that command came, there was a great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamentation. Most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed, and she sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. And Esther called for Hathlak, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. And Hathlak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Now, to this point, the king still doesn't know that she's Jewish. Here she is, his consort, his queen, his favorite wife. And she's in a position, Mordecai thinks, to speak a word to the king and get this edict changed somehow. And Hathlak went and told Esther what Mordecai had said, and Esther spoke to Hathlak and gave him a message from Mordecai saying, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death, unless the king holds out the golden scepter, and then he may live." In other words, you wait till you're called. See? And if you presume to come in there, it's only if the king is extremely gracious and he holds out his scepter and allows you to touch it, then you have an audience with the king. But apart from that, you presume to come into his royal chamber without being called, that's it. You're put to death. I can't go in there. I can't go, even for as important a cause as this, I can't go in there. He says, "I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to return answer to Esther, "Think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. Sooner or later, it's going to be known that you're Jewish. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's house will perish." I think if you were looking for a single sentence on which to base the theology that God has plan B, there it is. And I've preached that many, many times. People say God has no plan B. God only has one plan. That isn't so. God always has plan B and plan C and plan D and plan F and plan H and however many plans he needs. God's purposes are not going to be frustrated by our unwillingness to be obedient. His purposes are not going to be frustrated, but what will happen is that we'll miss the blessing. If God calls me to do something and I'm too sinful or I'm too fearful or whatever it is, I'm unwilling to do it, he's simply going to find somebody else to do it. He's got plan B. He's got plan C. And if you want a scripture to tie that to, here it is. Verse 14. "If you keep silent at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter." It will rise because God isn't finished with his people, you see. He's given too many promises to his people. Deliverance will rise from another quarter, but you and your father's house will perish. You're going to miss the blessing. And then what is probably the key sentence in the whole book, "And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And I submit to you that that sentence applies to every single one of us. Who knows whether you have not come to whatever position of influence you have for such a time as this? Who knows? There may be eternally significant consequences hanging upon your obedience. Now, if you fail, if you blow it, God's purposes aren't going to be frustrated. He'll find somebody else. But who knows whether his best plan might not have been to use you to change the course of history. Maybe not the whole course of history, maybe only a little side stream. But who knows whether that side stream wasn't eternally significant in God's purposes. And Mordecai says, "Esther, you're right, there's a risk. You haven't been called.
You go in there and you presume to march into his inner chamber without being called, and it may cost you your life. But listen, you have an opportunity to do something that might save your whole people. Who knows whether you haven't come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And I want you to see Esther's response. Verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maids will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." And Mordecai went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. It's a beautiful story. Mordecai uses persuasion and warning. And Esther responds, "Okay, I'll do it, but I need your help. I need you to stand with me. I want you to fast and pray." And notice that the fast is not only from food, but also from drink. It's no big deal to go for 3 days without food, but it's a very big deal to go for 3 days without drink. And that's very costly. But she says, "I and my maids will do that, and I expect you to stand with me, and we'll just beg God to prepare the way for this to be successful." Somebody read chapter 5. Tom, would you read it, please? Stand up.
On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner courts of the king's palace, opposite the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne inside the palace, opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come this day to a dinner that I have prepared for the king." Then said the king, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the dinner that Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." But Esther said, "My petition and my request is that if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition to fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the dinner which I will prepare for them. Tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and fetched his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, and all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the princes and servants of the king. And Haman added, "Even Queen Esther let no one come with the king to the banquet she prepared but myself. And tomorrow also I am invited to by her together with the king. Yet all this does me no good, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go merrily with the king to the dinner." This counsel pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made.
Thank you, Tom. Why do you suppose she does it this way? Invites him to dinner, not once, but twice. Sets him up. Why? Why don't you just come out with it? The king says, "I'll give you half my kingdom if you want it." But she courts the feelings of Haman. She makes him feel comforted. She makes him feel privileged. Nobody but the king himself was invited to dinner, not once, twice. I'm a pretty special person. But you know what? None of it matters so long as that doggone Mordecai sits there and he won't do obeisance to me. And you got to get the kind of poetic excess here. Say, a gallows 50 cubits high, that's 7.5 stories high. We're going to hang him from the yardarm, right? Going to really set him up. And the council pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Remember Mordecai? And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who had guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? He saved my life. What did we do to reward him?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows. Don't you love it? You got to read it, see? So the king's servants told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, the king's own, the robe off the king's own back, say, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. Let him array the man to whom the king delights to honor, and let him conduct the man on horseback through the open square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" And the king said to Haman, "Make haste. Take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he arrayed Mordecai and made him ride through the open square of the city, proclaiming, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had befallen him. And his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." And while they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and brought Haman in haste to the banquet that Esther had prepared. So he's been to one banquet, he's about to go to the other, and in the middle, his whole fortune turns around. Somebody read the 7th chapter for us. Joan, would you do that?
So the king and Haman went in to speak with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have held my peace. For our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he, that would presume to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was in terror before the king and the queen. And the king rose from the feast in wrath and went into the palace garden. But Haman begged for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen, my brethren?" As the words left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then said Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, "Moreover, the gallows which Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing in Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai. And then the anger of the king abated.
Okay. In essence, that's the story. There are still three chapters really to go, but that's the story. Haman is now out of the way. He's got his just desserts. He got exactly what he had planned for the Jews and for Mordecai in particular. But there's still the king's edict, which cannot be changed. And I'm not going to read the rest of this. I'll just tell you very quickly, what did they do? They get the king's permission to issue another edict. He can't change the first one, but he can issue another one. And the Jews are given permission to defend themselves against any attack, so that what is threatened to be a massacre against them turns out to be, in fact, the total destruction of their enemies. And that's the story of Esther, a Jewish maiden who is raised up through force of circumstances and behind the circumstances, the guiding hand of God, raised up to a position of tremendous potential power. She has to take the risk in using it. She takes the risk that in presuming to come into the king's chamber, she'll have no power at all. In fact, she'll be killed. But with Mordecai's encouragement and, in fact, with his cajoling, you're not going to be spared anyway. If you don't do this thing, the Jews are going to be massacred, and don't think that you're going to escape. Sooner or later, you're going to be found out, and you're going to get the same treatment as everybody else. That will not be the end of the Jewish people. God has made too many promises for that to happen. God will raise up deliverance, but you and your father's house will be destroyed. She takes that risk, she goes in, and she is blessed by God, she's anointed by God, and the whole of her people is spared. It's a very unusual book for several reasons. In the whole of the book of Esther, the name of God is never once mentioned. There is not a single reference to the Hebrew religion, the Jewish religion. The temple is not mentioned, even in the midst of this particular period of time when the temple is the focus of everything, the rebuilding of the temple, and then shortly thereafter the refortification of the city and the building of the city wall. Not once is it mentioned. Not a single aspect of Jewish ceremonial is referred to. Not one requirement of the law is mentioned. There's no mention of the promises of God except by implication. The implication is very strong, but it's not explicitly mentioned. There is no mention of the coming of his kingdom. There's no mention of Messiah. And yet, this book stands as one of the most profound stories of the overruling providence of God. And that's why it's in the Old Testament. God ordering the affairs of men and women. And this total woman, Esther, turns out to be one of the great heroes of history, one of the great, the all-time great heroes of history. They're saying of Margaret Thatcher these days that she's the best man in England. And Esther is clearly the best man or woman of her whole generation. She takes the risk. She rises to the occasion. There's no guarantee that she's going to be successful. But she seizes the opportunity. She exhibits the courage that is based on faith in God. She's willing to be used or to fail. And God does use her. And he saves a whole generation and changes their fate. And so that's the story of Esther. And may we take great encouragement from her example. It says that in chapter 9, verse 29, says, then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai the Jew, gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther enjoined upon the Jews, and as they had laid down for themselves and for their descendants, with regard to the fasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther fixed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing, and it has been and is now one of the great, great festivals of the Jews right down to the present day. King Ahasuerus laid tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was next in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brethren, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. Let's bow our heads together. Father, thank you for this story. It's so very simple, it's almost like a fairy tale. And yet we recognize that it's part of your holy history. We thank you for the courage of Mordecai, the willingness to be obedient to you, even if it cost him his life, and the courage of Queen Esther to put her life in jeopardy for the sake of her people and the honor of your name. Lord Jesus, we would dare to believe in whatever sphere of influence you have placed us, whether it be very great or very small, that you would have us exercise such courage as this. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? May we be obedient to what you would have us do, that it might lead to the blessing of others and to the praise of your name. For we ask it through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.